So much of it is taste and judgment, which, you know, you're not going to learn by listening to our podcast, sorry, but there are clear rules. You have to go out there and really think about the principles as they apply to your startup, to your ambition, to your market sector, and make the right calls. And you won't always make the right calls. You'll make mistakes, but the aim is to make fewer mistakes as time passes.
You're listening to the Startup Podcast. This is an educational episode. In-depth masterclasses about the concepts essential to building, running, and investing in Silicon Valley-style startups. Whether you're a founder, investor, or operator in a startup, you'll gain insights into the principles that power high-growth disruption, the same way Facebook, Google, and Uber do it. The conversation starts now.
Hey, I'm Chris Saad.
And I'm Yaniv Bernstein.
Welcome to the Startup Podcast. On today's show, we're doing a part two on our episode about enterprise sales. We're going to cover the essential role of focus in product development, why your customer requests are crappy roadmap additions, why good opportunities are actually risky catastrophes, why your clever feature ideas are likely to cost 10 times more than you think, and resolving power struggles between sales and product. All that and more on this week's The Startup Podcast. Stay tuned.
This episode of the Startup Podcast is brought to you by Vanta. You might know that sinking feeling. You're about to land a big contract when they ask about compliance, SOC 2, ISO, PCI, Essential 8. You've just snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. Not anymore. Vanta massively accelerates your compliance efforts and allows you to get those life-changing deals back on track. Don't wait until it's panic stations, though. Get started with Vanta today. They're offering 20% off their prices just for TSP listeners. Do yourself a favor. Hit pause, go to vanta.com/TSP. That's VANTA.com to get that 20% off.
All right, Yaniv. So in a recent episode, you and Clementine Jacoby did an awesome, awesome conversation about enterprise sales. But actually not just enterprise sales, but the intersection of product management and enterprise sales and how to minimize distraction or derailment or defocusing from commitments and obligations from large enterprise customers.
That's right. I think we're really talking about how do you work with enterprises as a smaller startup without ending up being utterly beholden to them.
Yeah, that's right. It's a really challenging thing. And it's something we talk about implicitly on the show on and off throughout the entire series. And I was really glad to hear a whole episode dedicated to it. And I thought it was a really, really awesome conversation. But what we figured we'd do, since I unfortunately had to miss that episode, is do a part two where we can unpack some of the topics further and add even more color and more detail, in particular from my point of view as well.
Let's do it. Where would you like to start?
So if you haven't heard that episode, I'd obviously recommend you go back. It's only probably one or two episodes back. It's called Enterprise Sales. Have a listen to that one first, and then we will dig into some of those topics and go further. So the first thing that you guys touched on that I wanted to unpack and go into a bit more detail on was, why is contractual obligations from enterprise customers and the potential of that distracting the roadmap a really bad idea? Right? These things that at first appear like great opportunities, right? It's a customer willing to pay you money to do a thing. Sometimes there is what's maybe called NRE or upfront payments, non-recurring engineering and upfront payments. You sometimes want to put a big ticket price on that. It feels validating. It feels like you found a real problem. And you guys correctly talked about how this can be a lack of focus, that it can be demoralizing to the team because they signed up to build products. And all of that is absolutely true. But what I wanted to add to that list is really what I think is the most important reason why, as a product company, a company with ambitions to scale to millions and millions of users, find hockey stick curves, and not be an agency, is that product is really, really hard to build. And it requires a great deal of polish, thoughtfulness, handling of corner cases, edge cases. And in my mind, and not everybody agrees on this, a product should be self-serve, at least large parts of it, that a user should be able to onboard themselves, get to an aha moment, and be successful without intervention from human beings. And that's a really, really high bar. High product bar requires a great deal of polish. And polish requires sustained focus and intention over time. And so what happens is when you have a lot of inbound requests from sales and partnerships that get you to jump from this feature to that feature to that feature, you never have the time to invest in making the features polished, handling edge cases, and have them be self-explanatory and self-serve. And so you're very likely to mitigate the outcome of a product, and it never rises to that bar of being a product. And that is the main reason, I think, that enterprise sales obligations that derail your roadmap can be extremely problematic and actually potentially cannibalize or mitigate your success.
I think that's right. It's really around that distraction. And the phrase I always think of is losing control of your roadmap. Instead of saying, okay, these are the things that we prioritize because we think they're important for the product, we effectively have the prioritization decided for us by our customers who want specific things and don't necessarily, you know, the incentives are not aligned, right? They want what's best for them, not what's best for our product or for our startup. And so I think that's what gets really problematic.
It's more subtle than that because I think most people think of their roadmap as features to ship, right? Things to do. And so once the feature is quote unquote done, it's shipped and it's done and great. We get to move on to the thing our customer asked us to do, right? And it doesn't feel too bad because you're just ticking things off the list. But what I'm talking about is when you raise the bar of what done means to be productized, which means polished and self-serve, marketed and measured and iterated and polished, it's not so much just did the roadmap get derailed, but the quality of the execution on every milestone on the roadmap gets derailed. And it's a subtle but important difference.
I understand what you're saying. And, you know, I think Clementine made two really good points in the previous part of this episode, part one of this episode rather, that address that or speak to that. So the first is she talked about systems integrators, and that's a term I knew and I kind of got the idea vaguely about what they did, but she articulated it really well, which is really saying create an ecosystem, in some way platformize your product so that that custom work, that work that's one-off, that's non-recurring, that's only for one customer, can be done by a third party that sells its time. That is more like from an agency line, a systems integrator. That means you might need to expose some APIs or at least some clean interfaces or admin tools or whatever, so that even if there is complex configuration and things that need to be built along on the side, you don't have to do it. So you can say, well, okay, sure, you need these features. We're not going to build them into the product. Meet our systems integrator, they will build them into your version of the product, or they will integrate them with your existing systems, of course, which is where the term comes from, and therefore it doesn't distract you. And I think that is really smart, right? So then you're effectively productizing the customization rather than trying to do it for each customer. So that's one thing she said that was really valuable. And then the other, which I love, is she talked about software always being a last resort, which I think is a flip side of what we talk about a lot, Chris, but I think it was a pretty cool way of articulating it, right? Which is we talk about the value of software is in its very low marginal cost of distribution, right? Like you spend the money once or you spend the time and effort once to build the software and then millions of people can use it. Right. And so we talk about that from a positive sense, but we also talk about why that's a good fit for the venture capital model is high upfront expense. Right. So building software only makes sense if you do get that massive distribution. Right. Building software that is going to rarely be used is rarely a good idea. And, you know, I'm an engineer by background. I used to work with all these engineers who they would have some repetitive task that might take them 1 minute once a week. And they'll be like, oh, we should automate this. And they would spend a week automating this 1 minute task. And I'm like, how many minutes are there in a week, guys? Like the return on investment on this is going to be over 20 years before you get that time back. Because what they've done is, I had a whole episode recently on leverage, Chris. Like software is about leverage, and that leverage is you get to use it a lot. If you're building software that's not going to be used a lot, and in the context of enterprise sales, software that's only going to be bought by one customer, you are negating that leverage advantage. And so when you don't have the leverage of software, think about if there are things you can do to satisfy the customer that are not software. Can you run a report for them? Can you encourage them to hire an offshore contractor to do some manual work instead of building a feature into your software?
Actually, I want to use that as a great segue to the next topic. But just before we get to that, the great thing about system integrators or agencies that are certified to support or extend or integrate your software is that they can act as distribution partners. So once they get trained and upskilled on what you do and how you do it, they can then start referring you to their customers. So that's very, very valuable. But the building of APIs and extensibility points and understanding the water's edge where your product ends and other things begin requires that discipline and polish that I talked about. And so if you don't have the discipline to say no and instead invest in that clean endpoint, you'll never have it be extensible in that way. But this brings me to my next point, Yanev, which is you said, if the software is not going to get used a lot, then you shouldn't be building it. And presumably that means, you know, used across many customers, used a lot by each customer, not a one-off. The other thing I wanted to unpack a little bit more from part one was that's certainly true. If it's not on your roadmap and you don't think it's going to get used a lot, then you don't want to do it. However, the trick is that a lot of people add a lot of shit to their roadmap when customers ask for things. So they go like, oh, we hadn't thought about that. But that actually seems on trend, on track, on strategy. So yeah, we'll add it to the roadmap and maybe even add it to the roadmap right now. And so they'll either bring something forward that was already on the roadmap, or they will think something is a good enough idea to add to the roadmap. But the problem is that those things can actually be just as catastrophic, because bringing something forward is potentially a reprioritization that is inappropriate. There's a reason why it was further down on the roadmap, because there are other dependencies or other table stakes that needed to get done first. Or the thing you think is clever may be clever, but not on strategy. And I see this all the time. The clearest example, of course, is white label. So they're building a branded B2B2C product, and the customer says, well, I want this to be white label. And they're like, oh, I guess that's a good idea. A lot of customers might want it white label. We'll add it to the roadmap. And in fact, we'll add it to the roadmap as the next milestone. And it's like, wait a second, that is not the business model or strategy of the company. Or maybe it's not the strategy for this cycle, for like this year. And so it sounds like a good idea. It sounds like a lot of customers may want it. But A, they may not. B, it may not be within the scope and mission of the product. Or C, it may be a violation or a corruption of your business model. And so that's the thing I wanted to unpack and go deeper on is, yes, if it's not on your roadmap, you don't want to do it. But many founders and product managers will add things to their roadmap that sound like a good idea, but are actually a violation of the overall strategy.
Completely. And I think what this comes down to is discipline. And again, I think what I was talking about with Clementine is that when you have something on your roadmap and a potential customer, a prospect, or an existing customer comes in and says, we want this thing, then that is a data point that should feed into a prioritization process. And like what you're talking about, Chris, I think is very valid, is about various cognitive biases and psychological effects that can cause that prioritization to be distorted. And, you know, I think that's where there's that saying, you know, you fall to the level of your systems, right? Which is like, when you're under pressure, it's the systems that make sense. And so to me, it's like you nearly have to go upstream and say, what is our prioritization process like? How do we decide what our roadmap looks like in the first place? Like, how was it any good in the first place? And then we say we have a new data point. A new data point is feature X has been requested by this prospect. Let's run our prioritization heuristic again in the presence of this new piece of data and see if that changes it, right? If you have a good process for that, that is an appropriate way of doing things. We can say, okay, we got $1 million contract to build something that we were going to build in 6 months just to build it now. But the trick is, and I think to your point, Chris, you cannot fool yourself. That is genuinely what's happened. And you're like, we think that changes the priority of it, then by all means do it. But don't get those dollar signs in your eyes. Like, I think you get this sort of white line fever where people are like, money, it's money. Of course, it's a high priority. It's like, no, you got to put that away and say, no, let's have a dispassionate, rational reevaluation, right? You have a priority stack, new evidence, significant new evidence should lead to reprioritization. I think that is a good process. And I'm sure we've talked about that in previous episodes, including our one on prioritization. And so, you know, a major lead asking for something, a major client asking for something is new data, but it is not a command. It is customer discovery.
Yeah, that's right. It's, you know, we've talked about this before as like, hey, this is a really good opportunity that the customer is giving us. And the question is like, an opportunity for what and who, right? It's a good opportunity for them and it's a good opportunity for short-term revenue, but is it a good opportunity to build the scalable product and business that we're building? And then often you'll hear, but this is a really good idea. We should add it to the roadmap. But is it a good idea for your strategy? Is it a good idea right now? And does it fit into a cohesive plan? And so, yeah, as you said, Yanev, you need to run this through your proper filter and not just a filter of may some customers use this in the future. Yes, chances are someone somewhere will use that again. So it's not going to be just a one-off. It'll be a two-off or a five-off. But does it fit actually in your real strategy? The next topic that really struck me as you guys were talking was this idea of turning no's into learning opportunities, or rather turning feature requests into learning opportunities. And Clementine had this really, really great idea of actually not just saying yes or no, but actually going really deep with the enterprise for days, embedding with them and getting really, really deep into why that feature request was presented and what are they really thinking about and what pain and problem are they really solving? And then potentially mapping that to existing roadmap items, or perhaps revealing that that actually is not a real problem after all. And I think that's really a brilliant idea. And really understanding your customers and the sponsoring thoughts behind their feature requests is, of course, the right way to go. I wanted to add to that two additional points. The first is that you want to be a space heater, not a thermometer, in your interactions with enterprises. So they may believe they have a certain problem, or they may have a certain approach to solving that problem. What you need to be interested in doing is helping to educate them about the way they should think about their problems, or think about their best practices, or think about the way they do business, such that you're not handling every use case and workflow in your product. Rather, you're developing some sense of what is the right workflow, the best workflows, the common workflows, the best practices, and helping to educate your enterprise customers to align with the best practice that your product implements. And of course, not all companies will want to do that, but that may mean that they're not the right company at the right stage with the right use case and the right problem. And then the other thing I wanted to touch on was helping to educate enterprise customers about why they want you to say no. So helping them to understand that a vendor, a product-led world-class company, should be saying no to them more often. That your no, or your deflection or redirection or delay, is not the sign of an uncooperative vendor. It's the sign of a mature and sophisticated vendor. And in fact, your competitors or their other vendors should be acting this way more often, and help them to understand the high cost of polished product, the highly valuable behavior of a company acting to protect their products so that they can scale their business, build world-class best-of-breed products, and to ultimately deliver something that is being maintained, polished, useful, and sustainable over years. So you need to help them understand, if a vendor is being too amenable, they are actually a risky vendor. Their business may not be sustainable, or their product may not be best-of-breed over time. And that's a strategic problem for them. And that's, I think, a very useful thing to teach unsophisticated enterprise buyers.
The challenge that I would have is, like, that sounds all well and good in theory, but have you seen this work in practice? When we talk about, you're in a sales process and you have a customer who wants something and you're like, we're not going to give it to you. And let me tell you why that's good for you as well. Does that actually work? Have you seen it work?
Yes. Yeah, I've done it myself many, many times. In fact, I had a very large enterprise customer. It was really kind of the bet the farm customer, because they were our first biggest brand name and dollar sign. And we convinced them actually to wait, I want to say 2 years, for what they wanted, on the vision and the promise that what we were building was more generalized, sustainable, and useful for them in the long term, and would act as a stronger base and foundation for their long-term needs. I will say that I actually just wrote a post on LinkedIn about graceful degradation. It may or may not work, but it is the place to start. Or at least one of the things to try before you have to fall back to a change to your roadmap or a contractual obligation. You must at least try to explain to them your product strategy and your business strategy to be product-led, and why those two things are better for them than a vendor that is likely to acquiesce to every ask at any time. It's a very valuable and useful thing to do.
It's nice to have that proof point, Chris, that it can work. And, you know, having that confidence, I think, is valuable.
The next topic you guys touched on was the question of trying to understand the costs and benefits of taking on some custom work, or fast forwarding to a particular item on your roadmap for a customer. And you, of course, have to think about the cost of delivering on that feature. And you have to think about the return, either the revenue immediately from that customer, or the potential return of being able to ship this to many customers in the future. The key thing I want to unpack on this a little bit is the reality that whatever you think it's going to cost, probably you need to multiply it by 10.
Seems legit.
You're right. The worst version of this is the CEO asks his engineers, or the salesperson asks her engineers, hey, how much would this cost to build? Or can we build this? Or how long would it take us to do this? And the engineers go, oh, we could probably do that in a week or a month or a year. You haven't factored in the product management, the design, the build, the polish, the documentation, the support, the ongoing maintenance. You haven't factored in any of it, right? You've just factored in the engineering cost. That's the worst version of this.
For mine, the maintenance is like the real killer. Because, you know, you mentioned that, acronym, right? NRE, non-recurring expenses. Well, guess what? That shit is recurring. That maintenance burden is with you forever. So you get paid once as a non-recurring expense, but the cost to you is ongoing.
That's right.
And so that's just a really shit deal.
But what I described as the worst case, more sophisticated product-led companies will go, well, we asked product and we asked engineering and we asked sales and we figured out what we think the cost is. but you still haven't figured out the cost because you're not factoring in opportunity cost, what other scalable things you could build, executive cost, thinking about and negotiating and time splitting and figuring out how to like balance the needs of the short-term tactical need of this customer versus your long-term roadmap, on and on and on. And so whatever you think it's worth, it's at a minimum 10 times that. And you know, we talked about maintenance just now, Yanev. I'm just talking about upfront cost.
Yeah.
The upfront cost is 10 times more. And then the maintenance cost is 10 or 100 times more. And so I'm just wanting to implore you, as you're thinking about the cost-benefit analysis of custom work, you must really factor in the costs, all the costs. And then on the other side, the benefits. The benefits tend to be 10 times less than you imagine. Maybe you're guaranteed an upfront payment from this customer and you're factoring that in. When you think about other customers may want to use this, maybe, maybe not. If they were, it would have probably been on your roadmap anyway. Or if it was part of the core use case and problem set and persona you were targeting, it should have been on the roadmap anyway. And so very often you'll have sales come to you and say, oh, we could unlock a huge TAM if we just added this feature. And invariably that TAM is way smaller than they represent. And the actual market and wins they get as a result are way smaller than they represent. And so you have to 10x, 100x the cost, and you have to sensitize the upside, the return by 1/10. That is how you need to do the calculation well.
I think there's one interesting thing that, again, Clementine brought up that is a nuance I'd be interested in your take on, right? Like, I actually think if you think about selling into enterprise, the more standard playbook, and perhaps you could say the more recommended playbook, is you sort of start smaller. You start with SME or mid-market. You do some sort of product-led growth sort of thing. Start off in that more consumery mindset. And then as you succeed in that market, you work your way up because enterprise has a lot of requirements, right? And the truth is they have all of these asks, but a lot of those are in some sense non-negotiable, right? Like they cannot use your product unless you offer two-factor authentication or whatever it is, right? Like they just can't. And so you work your way up. And I think in that case, everything you say is correct. Clementine, and maybe this is more niche, but Recidiviz, their business, only sells to enterprise. There is no mid-market for them. They have to go straight. They've got a global market of 50 customers, right? And that's not unique. It's unusual. It's not unique. If you're in a situation like that, what she described is more a sort of product discovery by partnering with a couple of champion customers at the beginning. So in a sense, you are doing custom work, but you're not just listening to their wish list of features. You are doing, and you mentioned it earlier, you're doing deep product discovery with them. And you build something that is for them in a sense, but not based on what they've asked, but based on some deep insights that you have gained from them about that enterprise space that you are selling into. And you won't get everything right. So it's custom software, sort of, but in a very particular way. And in particular, you are still controlling what you build based on those discussions with those one or two customers.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, most of what I'm talking about here is about very large niches that have a chance to expand into very, very large adjacencies, mainstream adjacencies typically. And so, yeah, if you have a set, as she does, of like 10 or 50 customers, the entire total addressable market is 50 large customers, then what I'm saying here is probably off strategy. She was very eloquent and articulate about the nuances there, and I think she's threading that needle very, very well. But I also agree with your other statement, which is the best practice building B2B software is to build it very simple. You build a very simple MVP oriented around self-adopt by small businesses, and then you incrementally add more and more capabilities and enterprise features and work your way up market. The problem is with all of this panic and chaos around like, get the biggest revenue number as fast as you can and go sell enterprise customers and all the volume and dollars are over in an enterprise. And it's like companies skip all of those steps and they just go to the biggest check they can find because they want to get logos and they want to prove revenue and they end up wrapping themselves around the axle. And what they end up building is a bunch of enterprise tooling with a donut hole in the middle, which is the end user value and self-serve and delightfulness. That's the really, when you're in a bad spot.
I wanted to take a moment to talk about one of our sponsors, Trilogent. Trilogent is a global strategic advisory firm that is tailored to startups. But what does this mean? And what can Trilogent do for you? Say you're looking to expand into a new country. This is one of the riskiest moves any startup can make. It is all too easy to be blindsided by differences in the culture, the competitive landscape, regulatory gotchas, trademark disputes, hiring challenges, and so many other hidden landmines. Even if you get past all that, you're naked. All of your contacts, your reputation, your brand count for nothing. You're starting all over again on foreign ground. All those doors that open for you at home, they stay firmly shut in the new country. It's scary. So, what's a founder to do? Call Trilogent, of course. Trilogent's global presence combined with deep local expertise will give you access to local market experts, regulatory advice, and the best PR people, all under one roof. Plus, Trilogent's advisory board gives you access to an even broader network of domain experts nearly everywhere in the world. So if you've got a specific tricky issue and you need someone who really understands the space, Trilogent have you covered. As a startup, your context and narrative is constantly changing. Partnering with one single firm who truly understands your product and business goals early on is going to lead to greater efficiencies and, more importantly, to better outcomes in the long run. Finally, Trilogent is flexible and founder-friendly from a commercial perspective. Contact Trilogent today at www.trilogent.com and book a call with their wonderful COO, Laura, to find out how they can help you grow your startup with confidence. That's www.trilogent.com, T-R-I-L-L-I-G-E-N-T, to speak to Laura, their COO, today. This episode of the Startup Podcast is brought to you by Vanta. The team at Vanta are passionate about helping you secure your business by vastly cutting down on the time to get compliant with frameworks like ISO 27001, SOC 2, and Essential 8. Vanta lets you close deals, sleep better at night, and get back to building your product. Help yourself and help the podcast by going to vanta.com/TSP for an exclusive 20% off deal.
Now, the other topic that you guys touched on, which I thought was really interesting, was this idea that when you're pre-product market fit, you want to bias towards sales. And then when you're a post-product market fit, you want to have more discipline and bias towards product and roadmap. I think that's generally true. But again, here, there's an art and a discipline required. If you have a really, really massive net because you're pre-product market fit and you're just trying to figure out who will buy anything from you, you are putting at risk your ability to have the discipline and the focus to actually get to product. So if you are just like willing to talk to anyone about anything, and I'm exaggerating a little bit, but even if you're willing to talk about too broad a set of things, you will hear a lot of different signal and you will build a lot of different things, and none of it will be polished enough that it will rise to the level of product market fit. Because again, it's not sufficient to have the feature. The feature has to be polished, self-serve, self-explanatory, get you to an aha moment quickly. And so sometimes, often, almost always, getting to product market fit requires the focus and discipline of saying no to different customers that give you different requirements. So it is a little bit of chicken and the egg. You have to be disciplined about your product exploration so that you can then be disciplined about your product development so that it has a chance to find fit because of the nature of its polish and focus. And that is a real art, a real art.
So here's the way I interpret that, like pre-PMF bias to sales. It's actually what I was alluding to before, which is that especially in enterprise, if you're serving an enterprise space and you don't have product market fit, the vehicle for product discovery is sales, right? Meaning you don't leave it to the salespeople. And in fact, another episode perhaps we should discuss, you know, I hear this a lot in other podcasts and speaking to other founders, is for quite a while early in a startup, you do not hire salespeople. You as Absolutely. Founders are the salespeople. So in other words, you are out there selling this thing, and the sales motion is also your product discovery motion, because you don't even really know what it takes to sell yet, right? You don't have product market fit. Like by definition, if you're not able to successfully sell this thing, you don't have PMF. But the only way you can discover what it takes to successfully sell it is to try to sell it, right? And so I think that's my interpretation of that, right? Which is you don't sit in your ivory tower going, I wonder what this enterprise product should be, build it, then try to sell it. No, you try to sell the thing before you have it. You listen to your leads, but you don't just do what they tell you, right? You're listening, you're learning, you're diving deep. That's what Clementine was saying. And, you know, I think to me that makes a ton of sense.
Yeah. I mean, it takes judgment. It takes taste.
A lot.
And it takes product interpretation of pain into actual product solutions. And the judgment is like, you know, listening to a customer and going, oh yeah, I hear that, but I'm not interested in solving that. Or, oh yeah, I can understand why that might be a problem for you, but that's not a fit for something I'm passionate about or something that I can productize or something that I can scale. So good luck with that, right? So not everything the customer says is going to be interesting for you to sell against. And I 100% agree with you also, Yanev, that you have to own sales as the founder to figure out A, what you're building, and B, how to sell before you then step out and put someone else in who can be the salesperson to scale yourself to the next 100 sales.
And, you know, as a brief aside, right, like every salesperson knows, but for founders who don't come from a sales background, who are selling, right? Selling is not always about closing the deal. There's this concept of qualification, which means when you are working with a lead, you need to decide whether you want to sell to them, right? Like, it's actually a two-way process. And so I think the point here is selling, when you are selling to enterprise, it's particularly messy early on because you need to be doing the qualification and the discovery and the closing in this sort of iterative way with particular leads, right? Which is why you have to go deep, build a relationship with them, understand what they need, understand if you should be building it for them, and if you should be building it for them, then trying to actually close the deal, right? Like, it's not linear, it's iterative. And you're absolutely right, by the way, like so much of it is taste and judgment, which, you know, you're not going to learn by listening to our podcast, sorry, but there aren't clear rules. You have to go out there and really think about the principles as they apply to your startup, to your ambition, to your market sector, and make the right calls. And you won't always make the right calls. You'll make mistakes, but the aim is to make fewer mistakes as time passes.
Yeah, I mean, let's put a very fine point on that. You only have taste and judgment if A, you're born with it through some miracle, or B, it's been hard won through experience, or C, you cheat by bringing on experienced advisors, mentors, and people to help give you that taste and judgment. It's kind of the only three options. So make sure you get yourself into one of those camps. Otherwise, you're kind of stumbling around in the dark. Now, the other topic you guys touched on was when you're talking about roadmap and you're talking about decisions about what gets on the roadmap, what gets in the product, there was this notion of like, you don't want one side to always win, or you want it to be more of a feedback loop between sales and product, and you don't want that to get lopsided. And I would argue you don't want any particular organ in the business or function in the business to get lopsided or overly powerful, right? Engineering, marketing, sales, product, and so on. There needs to be a balanced and empowered group of functions working together and pushing and pulling it from their perspectives to create the right creative outcomes. However, in a product-led company, product management is half a step ahead and should be making final executive decisions, barring intractable conflict that you need to escalate, about what makes it onto the roadmap. And the reason for that is because they sit in a privileged place of getting data from engineering and marketing and sales and biz dev and customer support and what have you. And so they have an unfair advantage in terms of their perspective, and they are the holders of the strategy, the product strategy, and can filter everything through that product strategy. Now, that does not mean, though, that they're going to turn a blind eye to sales. As I said, they're going to be very, very curious and interested and engaged in the needs of every function. But I would say they want to go one step further than that, which is they don't want to just hear from customers through the action of sales. They want to go reach out to customers directly and learn from their customers and the market directly. Sales should not be the only channel by which product hears about customer requests. That's very, very important, because customer requests via sales are a particular kind of request. And then the other thing that you want to think about is, and this is a trick question that I ask product managers when I interview them, you know, I'll say large enterprise customers or large partners will often come with contractual obligations or asks or demands that can thrash your product roadmap. How do you minimize or mitigate that as a product leader? And the common answer, the obvious answer is, well, I build a great relationship with sales and I participate in deal reviews and I try to generalize requirements and make sure that they're not just specific for one customer. And that's all fine and good, but it is mostly wrong if that's all you do. What you actually need to do as a product leader is be very, very interested in the criteria, the qualification criteria by which sales is qualifying leads, and the mechanisms by which marketing is generating leads, so that they are using vocabulary, features, benefits, and qualifying criteria that are set by product. Because product should have predetermined those things prior to setting the roadmap and the strategy, or as part of setting the strategy and having it follow through to the roadmap. And so you should be building features for a very specific kind of customer with a very specific kind of problem set. And then sales and marketing should be attracting and engaging with that same very specific customer. And so their asks, their requirements should be within the scope of inquiry and concern of your product roadmap already. And so it's about mitigating the thrash right upstream before the customers even come into the process. that's a really, really important thing. And that's done through, obviously, defining your customer, your problem well, but it's then also done through sales enablement, through the product team and the product marketing team getting right up in the grill of marketing and sales and participating in sales enablement, helping them to sell and market so that they sell and market to the right people in the right way.
Okay, that was a lot. I've been holding my tongue. I don't disagree with anything you said, but I also think in a sense, you're a bit begging the question, because what you're saying is in an environment where you have an excellent product management function and product is appropriately empowered, then this problem doesn't exist. But I think what happens in the real world all too often is that we have a power imbalance and also potentially not an optimally excellent product function. And so what you see in the real world, let's say, is two fairly common dysfunctions, right? One is the sales-led org, where product, regardless of whether they're competent or not, simply lack that power, that ultimate decision-making power. And so sales are like, hey, we're bringing in the Benjamins, and therefore you have to build the thing that we want, and the CEO backs us, and you know that's what happens. But then the other dysfunction I do think is pretty common is product managers in their ivory tower, right? Ideating on whiteboards and not doing all of that listening, not just to sales, but to all the other functions, right? We're like, we are purists. And I think everything you say, like I said, I agree with Chris, but I think someone listening could walk away with the wrong impression that it's like, we shouldn't allow our beautiful product thinking and our excellent product taste to be sullied by contact with the real world, right? By like actually listening to what the sales team is hearing, from what customer support is hearing, from what marketing is hearing, from all of their discovery work. And I agree, good product management is the art of taking all of that, appropriately weighting it, bringing it all together, and creating an incredible product. But, you know, we just talked about this in a recent episode, in our Reacts episode, when we talked about like the, what I'm calling the crisis in product management. That level of excellence is rare. And so I think there is often this balancing of power dynamics where it's like, okay, sales and product, I think especially, are the two functions that are at risk of having out of control power in an organization. And that causes distortions and it needs to be well balanced. I think that's actually really important.
Yeah. I mean, if you're hearing from what I'm saying that product can or should sit in an ivory tower and not really listen to sales, then you're not hearing me correctly, right? Like, I know, Yanev, you're trying to be the audience surrogate and trying to make sure that any objections that might be popping up are addressed. And I would say to that objection in the audience's mind, you're not hearing me properly. I'm saying they need to hear and listen to every function and use all the data and all the perspectives to triangulate a great product strategy, including speaking directly to customers, right? That's essential. What I'm saying there is very deliberate and very essential. And then the other thing you said is, well, it's often not ideal. There's often a power imbalance and the PMs might not be good enough and the sales team might be too powerful and so on. I would say that's not a possibility, Yanev. I would say that is the most common situation in most companies most of the time. But rather than say, well, that's theoretical and not possible, I would argue, as all I always argue, move towards the bloody ideal. You know, be a better CEO, be a better executive team, rebalance that power, empower your PMs to take that half step ahead of the team and lead, hire better product managers if you think your product managers are not competent enough. And more often than not, I find there's no chief product officer. There's no one at the executive level who can argue for and provide power dynamics for the product management team. And so hire a competent CPO who understands these principles. And I will say that's much, much harder said than done. I've recently gone through an exhaustive search for a chief product officer in Australia. We didn't find one. We used like a really, really great recruiter who has access to some of the best talent in the country. And we could not find a CPO that could rise to the level that I was looking for.
Well, there you go. And so that's right.
I'm not arguing this is easy. I'm arguing it's worthwhile. I'm arguing it's important. I'm arguing that it will be a huge differentiator for your company to have incredible, competent, empowered product leadership that can build sustainable, long-term, and scalable products that sales can sell successfully and that can actually grow itself, a product that can grow itself as well.
Okay, so I think maybe where I like my last word on this is with great power comes great responsibility. And I think to have a product team that has the full power of its function, which is basically having full control over the roadmap, you need to have a bloody excellent product team. And to your point, Chris, like, yes, it is worth aspiring to, but if you don't have one, you need to make appropriate adjustments. And I think that's important to consider as well.
Sounds like a perfect segue for my ad.
With great power comes great responsibility. You need to do product really well if this is going to work. And if you're not sure that you're doing that, well, help is at hand. Chris makes a business, don't you, out of helping companies really accelerate and improve their product function so that you don't have these weird distortions. So if folks want to work with you, Chris, how can they find you?
Yeah, that's right. And you can find me at chrissard.com/advisory and you can learn about my work there. Or subscribe to my newsletter over at chrissard.com/newsletter.
If you've been listening to this podcast and getting value out of it for more than an episode or two, don't forget, it's not free. I drink so much caffeine, I'm incredibly caffeinated right now. In fact, I'm hurting Chris's ears. So please help me not have an aneurysm. Like, follow, subscribe to our podcast on YouTube and give us a shout out on LinkedIn or wherever you have an audience. That is your responsibility. We are so grateful every time. It's what keeps us going. It's what helps us grow the podcast, help more people, bring on the best guests. So thanks very much for holding up to your end. We have no way of enforcing this. So just look inside yourself and think, am I the sort of person who doesn't honor a pact? Of course not. You're a good person. So go ahead and do that.
All right, Yanev, that was tons of fun. As always, I guess I'll catch you in the next one.
Absolutely. Godspeed, Chris.
See you later, guys. Bye-bye.
This episode of the Startup Podcast was brought to you by Vanta. Vanta helps businesses get and stay compliant by automating up to 90% of the work for the most in-demand compliance frameworks. With over 200 integrations, you can easily monitor and secure the tools your business relies on. Head to vanta.com/TSP for 20% off their incredible offering and start unlocking extra revenue today.